Okay, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. It is Thursday, the 9th of March, 2017. Welcome, everyone here. We are going to be having public hearings on Senate Bill 197, Senate Bill 865, and 866. I'm going to open 197, that's the dairy air bill, to hear testimony from Senators Hansel and Johnson, and then we will go back to the other two bills, 865 and 866, which I hope we can address fairly precipitously. So, and then we'll come back to the air quality bill. So I'm going to open our public hearing on Senate Bill 197. Beth, could you tell us what 197 does?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 197 would direct the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt by rule a program for regulating air contaminant emissions from dairy confined animal feeding operations based to the extent feasible on the recommendations of the Task Force on Dairy Air Quality.
Okay, thank you, Beth. Mm-hmm. Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Hansel, State Senator for District 29, North, Central, and Eastern Oregon. I'm here to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 197 and to express my deep concern about the thinking of some that big is bad, that because you are a large family farming operation, you become undesirable just because you are big. The assumption is made you don't care about the environment and your product is less than ideal for human consumption. But perhaps the most unfortunate result of the big is bad mentality, as seen in Senate Bill 197, is the harm this does to the medium and small family farming operations. I have 9 dairies in my district, and every one of them is a family farm operation, regardless of size. These smaller dairies do not have the capacity, the scope, the size, or resources to comply with these regulations arguably targeted for the big farms. For example, here's some facts for Three Mile Canyon Farms, the largest of the dairies in the state and in my district. All of the milk from this dairy was developed to supply a new cheese factory built in Boardman at the Port of Morrill. This was a new business to Eastern Oregon and did not materially impact milk contracts in other parts of the state. Coupled with the fact that no small dairies were purchased to create Three Mile Canyon Farms, the claims of Friends of the Family Farms that somehow Three Mile is responsible for the consolidation of the dairy farm industry is sheer fantasy. Consolidation is a function of domestic and international competitive trends in the market. Three Mile has 300 full-time employees with an annual payroll of excess of $12 million. As a union-organized farm, the United Farm Workers, Three Mile offers living wages, benefits, and career opportunities to a culturally diverse workforce. Thirdly, to help Oregon become a leader in reducing reliance on fossil fuels, Three Mile has a diverse array of renewable energy projects, such as wind turbines, and a methane digester producing 4.5 megawatts with a solar project about to be developed. The manure digester developed with Oregon business tax credits helped improve our air quality by reducing 152,000 tons of CO2 equivalent, which is similar to removing 38,000 cars from Oregon roads, produces enough reliable renewable energy to power 7,000 homes, and provides a low-cost source of nutrient to develop 8,000 acres of organic farm produce. None of this is new. For 18 years, Three Mile Canyon Farms has maintained its reputation as one of the leading sustainable farms in Oregon. It uses a closed-use system, a loop system to recycle all farm waste. Water wisely through precision irrigation is used and surrendering one-third of its water rights to keep local streams and rivers full. Donated 23,000 acres to a wildlife conservation preserve to provide habitat for threatened species and protecting for Columbia Basin grasslands. To say big is bad just isn't true. Senate Bill 197 harms all dairy farms in the state, regardless of size. I urge you to rise above Senate Bill 197 and not be detrimental to the family farming industry of our state. Dairies are crucial to my district, the economy of Oregon, and a way of life to hundreds of people across the state. Senate Bill 197 will hurt this industry immensely, and I urge you not to move 197 forward. Big isn't necessarily bad, and dairies are crucial to our state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Johnson, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson, and I proudly, along with Senator Roblin, represent 94 dairies that are the backbone of the economy of Tillamook County. I also have three in Clatsop County and one in Columbia County. I hope it's not lost on this committee or the audience or anybody listening to this that a Democrat and a Republican are standing together today in opposition of this bill. For decades, Oregon dairy farmers have been among the most progressive in the country in terms of environmental stewardship. In total, Oregon is home to 228 dairy farm families who care for 125,000 dairy cows across the state in 21 of its 36 counties. In 2015, these Oregon dairies contributed an excess of $475 million in economic value to Oregon's economy, down, I'm sad to say, from the 2014 contribution of $650 million. The point of the story is cheese, ice cream, dairies are an important part of our agricultural economy. I know from the emphasis that Tillamook Creamery Association puts on high quality and the premium value that it's held in other places, Asia particularly, is testimony to the fact that our Tillamook brand is known internationally and valued for its purity and the environmental stewardship of the dairy farmers, who are among the most progressive in terms of their dealing both with their animals and with the land. These hardworking families should not be rewarded for their strong stewardship with more regulation. Air quality in most of Oregon, including Tillamook County, is great, and the dairies in my district are working hard to ensure that things stay that way. DEQ has much higher priorities that they should be pursuing, and we should not be giving them extra money to spend regulating dairy farmers who are already doing their part. I was part of the original Dairy Air, and I think that there's some mythology in the building right now that this was a mandatory program. It never was. The recommendation said voluntary as money becomes available and as best practices call for it. I'm stealing, and I'm going to bungle it slightly, but I'm stealing and paraphrasing a comment made by a colleague who said that technology and innovation are moving faster than the speed of regulation. And I would plead with you not to damage this important economic contributor in our state by larding on a bunch of regulation that I believe is unnecessary. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Questions?
Colleagues, any questions for either of these senators?
No.
Okay, yes, Senator Roberts.
I was going to ask Betsy, where do you stand on this issue?
This is one of the worst bills to come. Next question.
Stay tuned, Senator. We may have worse for you. So,
yeah. Until next week. Huh?
I'm going to go home and eat a Tillabar. So I'm
thank you for accommodating.
Yes, Senator Hensel, and happy anniversary.
Thank you.
Is he staying around for the other two?
No.
No.
Okay, so I'm gonna leave this hearing open, and I'm gonna open a hearing now on Senate Bill 865. And so I'll ask April Snell and Marion Nash and Mark Thalaker to please come up. So these two bills are kind of related, and we're going to try to keep the time we spend on these to about 15 minutes each. So if you could all be very quick, and those who will be coming up to speak to your objections to these bills, if you could just put your issues on the record. It seems pretty clear to me that we're going to have to bring people together to try to find some solutions to these. So April, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, April Snell, Executive Director of the Oregon Water Resources Congress, and I'll be testifying in support of both Senate Bill 865 and Senate Bill 866. And so in the interest of time, if it's acceptable to you, Chair Denbrough, I'll give kind of an overview of what we're trying to do with both bills, go into a little bit of the details on 865, and then go into more of the details on 866 for that second part of the hearing.
Okay, I'm fine with that. I'll just go ahead and open a public hearing on 866 as well.
Okay, so I could do it on that. Okay. So thank you very much for the opportunity to come before the committee. And our organization is in support of both Senate Bill and 865 and Senate Bill 866. We'll be submitting some written testimony for the record directly following the hearing. And just want to give a little bit of a background on why these two bills are so important to our members and why they are being proposed together. So both of these bills are a product of two intertwined issues that have, in one way or another, been before the legislative body in previous years, but never in their current form and not as a package. And what both of these bills get at is that there are different situations around the state where urban development has occurred around traditional agricultural lands. And as that happens, sometimes there are unintended consequences that arise that could be prevented if there was additional communication and cooperation between public entities. So the Oregon Water Resources Congress is a nonprofit association representing irrigation districts, water control districts, drainage districts, and other similar entities around the state. And so when there's development that occurs in and around our district facilities, and if the districts are not able to provide input or if their input is summarily ignored, then it leads to very costly and time-consuming litigation on the part of the district, the city, the county, the developer, and any other parties that are involved. And so we are very much open to constructive criticism and feedback that we could use to improve the language in one or both of these bills. But Senate Bill 865 relates to plat review. And this is a subject that is actually not new. Historically, irrigation districts and other agricultural water suppliers have been able to literally approve and veto plats in some of their cities and counties. This authority was statewide until 1993, when it was completely removed from the statute, with little legislative history as to why that occurred. Since then, some cities and counties have still honored that in some fashion or have memorandums of understanding that allow the districts to participate in the land use process prior to the final final platting so that they can give critical information to the cities and counties so that they can make informed decisions about development. But in other cities and counties, since the 90s, when this authority was removed, there has been development that has occurred without the district's knowledge, without their input, that has resulted in litigation in a variety of forms. This litigation harms not only the district and the patrons they serve, but the developers that are doing everything that they're supposed to do to have development, and to the cities and counties and the citizens therein that ultimately pay the legal bills for what occurs from this. So there appears to be a bit misinformation about what we're trying to do with the plat review bill. And so just to clarify, there is nothing in the bill currently that says that districts will be vetoing or, in essence, approving plats. It simply would ensure that the district receives notice and has an opportunity to provide recommended actions to the city or county that they may or may not use in moving forward with that plat. The way that the language is currently worded is it doesn't indicate where in the statute this piece would go, because as I mentioned, the original statutory authority was removed. So we envision that this would be prior to the final plat, and how that happens I think is something that we're not the experts in, but it would just create that opportunity for districts to give information such as, hey, I have a canal here, you may not want to build into the backside of that with a porch or other things like that. And you may think those things don't happen, but they do. And unfortunately, there are a number of governing bodies who've weighed in on this particular bill and said, well, we already do that. Well, if you already do that, great. How about we allow for all the districts and other entities to have that same level of interaction with their county or city and have the informed decisions in advance? And so it's not something that has an additional tool to it. It's really the ability for the districts to provide the information. And the districts who need this the most are not going to come here today and are not going to submit anything for the record because they fear retaliation from the city or county that they currently work with. But there are several issues around the state that have arisen from the lack of having plat review. So I will stop on the plat review and we'll submit more on that later, but I will say we've already proposed an amendment for that, and we're very open to other language that we could include in that. And I will say that two pieces that we will be fixing in 865 is to reduce the time from 30 days to 15 days, which matches what we've heard from some county planners to being in more alignment with their time frames. And that we would take out some language that's currently in there about endorsement thereon, because what we're seeking to do, there is no endorsement that the district would make. They would simply provide information that would be based on their board-approved policies. So briefly on Senate Bill 866, this is about stormwater discharge, and it is a product of what has happened in some places where there hasn't been plat review and there has been stormwater from non-agriculture urban impervious surfaces that has in some cases intentionally been discharged into the canal of an irrigation district or similar entity without that district's permission, without their knowledge, and without any understanding of the liabilities that go along with that. When those situations have occurred, it has led to extremely costly litigation, which also impacts not only our members, but the developers and the citizens of the state that ultimately have to pay for all of that. So the Senate Bill 866 related to stormwater discharges doesn't create any new authorities. It simply would require public entities to come together and create an agreement and figure out how they're going to deal with the liabilities that can arise from discharging non-agricultural stormwater into conveyance systems that are designed primarily for irrigation purposes. So knowing that we have a lot of other folks that are going to testify, including the two folks on either side of me, I will sum it up by saying that both Senate Bill 865 and Senate Bill 866 will help increase coordination between public entities, reduce delays to development, and prevent adverse impacts to irrigated agriculture and Oregon's water resources. And with that, I will conclude my remarks on this particular topic and happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, April. Mr. Thalacker. Okay.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough and committee members. My name is Mark Thalacker. I'm the manager of Three Sisters Irrigation District. When I moved to Oregon in 1988 and started farming, there were 80 farms in Three Sisters Irrigation District, and now there are 193. Since I've been manager since 1997, we have now piped 55 of the 64 miles in the district to deal with Clean Water and Endangered Species Act concerns and restore stream flow. As we went along during that journey, we went through over a dozen different lawsuits, basically over dealing with land use and plats and all sorts of things with some of our water users and some of our non-water users. You know, part of this problem stems back to the fact that title companies don't insure anything having to do with water on the title reports. So as a result, people really don't know where they stand. And in prior to me being manager, it was easy because a plat would come before the district and the district could explain to them that they needed to regard their right-of-ways and not cause problems for the other water users in the district. I would say that district probably spent over $1 million in litigation over the last 20 years dealing with these problems. And ultimately, I had one just yesterday where I've got a farmer who forgot a commitment that he made during a plat back in 1996 and didn't issue an easement to another one of the water users. And so we're having to get that straightened out right now. Plats are an easy way for the district to sit down with the county or the city and address any issues. And considering that most of these canal right-of-ways are federal right-of-ways under the 1891 Act and Homestead and others, you would think that this would be a place where the cities and counties would want to get this right from the get-go. Anyway, I totally support the bill today, and we need this tool so that we can avoid fights not only with developers and landowners, but also with the counties and the cities. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Thalker. Marianne.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, Marianne Nash here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau. When we met with April earlier this year and heard about this concept, our water committee generally thought this was an issue that should be addressed so that, you know, any farmers within districts that are building new facilities, shops, or barns that require land use approval know where they stand in relation to their district and are able to accommodate any district requests to make sure that they aren't interfering with district infrastructure. So we think it is a worthwhile concept and appreciate your consideration. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, can I have Carrie Handley, Aaron Doyle, and John Chandler, please? John and Ms. Handley, you're signed up for both bills. Feel free to comment on both of them. Erin, or
good afternoon, Chairman, Senator Dembrow, and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Handley. I work for the City of Gresham, and I am the Stormwater Permit Coordinator. Our city's understanding is that these bills are put forward in the interest of irrigation districts. While generally we do support the idea of creating appropriate structures and procedures to ensure safe discharge of safe water from one entity to another, we emphasize that these structures need to be proposed where these structures do not already exist. I'm here to comment about specifically Senate Bill 865 duplicates a notification procedure within the City of Gresham between ourselves and the Multnomah County Drainage District. This notification occurs during the pre-application and land use approval process, which is earlier than the plat process. The 30-day timeline is not consistent, and I did hear the proposed amendment, but we would note that it is unclear what would happen to our existing process if this bill were in place. So we caution, and therefore we oppose Senate Bill 865. Senate Bill 866, we feel, is an overreach of authority. It references the Clean Water Act and the state water quality standards, but appears to be applied anywhere across the state, indeterminate of population size. As you're aware, the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality administers the Clean Water Act as it relates to urban populations. We do have existing controls, such as stormwater management plans, stormwater master plans, and stormwater development manuals, and we already have existing permitting and notification procedures in place to notify about the discharge of stormwater. Specifically, it is one thing to envision this bill as affecting only private man-made canals and irrigation districts, but the language also applies local government to local government and describes requesting approval to discharge to another's infrastructure. In reality, permitted cities and counties actually discharge to natural water bodies via stormwater pipe outfalls. Streams, creeks, and rivers are not stormwater infrastructure and must not be defined as such. We do not want to create a precedent that would set up a system for us to need to request permission to discharge water from one uphill entity to another through a natural water course that has historically existed before our political boundaries. For example, could every city and county in the Willamette watershed be prohibited from discharging stormwater without the permission of Portland because they are the downstream local government? In Gresham, the drainage district has responsibility for pumping water to manage the Columbia Slough. Therefore, the drainage district's authority is over the Columbia Slough itself. It's not just man-made canals. So again, the language in this bill is simply too broad and overreaching. In order to comply, as we interpret the language currently, we would have to manage all of the water within our boundary to disallow it from discharging to the Columbia Slough or pay any associated liability or requested fee to the drainage district. Either one of these scenarios applied across the state would likely result in the paralysis of Oregon's economy because of litigation and associated fees for discharging. In Gresham, the financial impact to the development community and the city is estimated to be somewhere between $50 million and $200 million respectively. This would likely grind development to a halt, heavily impact our economic development efforts, and spike stormwater fees well beyond residents' ability to pay. And I will also note that agricultural water isn't specifically referenced in the language. So again, the language is too broad and confusing. Therefore, we oppose Senate Bill 866. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd like to make a statement or a comment to what you mentioned. It was a question I had on my mind. Does every jurisdiction downstream of Gresham have authority to preclude you from discharging water? And you had talked about, will Portland have the authority over you? And we'd look at St. Helens and Kalatskana and everybody down from there. That was a big question I had about this bill. I'm glad you broached it. What would be your answer to that?
As we currently read the language, that appears to be what it's requesting.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Erin?
Sure. Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, Erin Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities on Senate Bill 865 alone. A colleague of mine will address 866. Our issue with the bill, in talking with my planning folks, who are actually the ones that do this from day to day, is that this is probably the primary concern is that the plat process is too late in the game to really have made the right decisions about how we impact their infrastructure. But more importantly, in doing some digging this over this issue today, I came across section ORS 92.044, adoption of standards and procedures governing approval of plats and plans. And section 1D requires the procedures established by each ordinance by a city or county or regulation shall provide for the coordination and the review of the tentative plan of any subdivision or partition with all affected city, county, state, and federal agencies and all affected special districts. So I do believe that the notice requirement is already on us. And if there is a failure to provide that notice during that process, that pre-finalization of the plat, then there is a notice deficiency and therefore a land use cause of action. And therefore, if our cities are consistently doing this incorrectly, there should be a record of that with LUBA, and they should be correcting those within their statutes. So in my assessment, I point you to the testimony of my experts who have submitted, City of Staten and City of Bend, who have been working through these processes with irrigation districts that lie within their boundaries for more of the technical analysis. But it's my assessment that we have a procedure in place to provide that notice. And if we are failing to do it, that is something that we need to be I can help assist our members in learning about that, making sure that they're doing it correctly. I can't speak for the counties, but there's only 36 of them, so I imagine those conversations will be faster. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. With regard to Senate Bill 865, we are opposed to the bill as written. From talking to the proponents, I think we could probably get to a point of neutrality. Our concern, though, with the printed bill is that it would seem to give irrigation districts a veto over the plat process, which strikes us as a remarkably bad idea. One of your previous panelists talked about the removal of the district's authority in 1993. That was part of my doing. I don't frankly recall exactly what the parameters of that discussion were, but it had to do with the fact that cities and counties under Oregon land use law are charged with issuing plats. Other service providers, irrigation districts, fire districts, what have you, are then charged with responding to that, and they, the districts, the cities, the counties, are supposed to play nice with one another and talk to each other. That there's a couple cases from 93 that were particularly aggressive, shall we say. And so the power was taken, the authority was taken away. I'm perfectly fine, and I think, as Ms. Doyle pointed out, there is a process in place for notification. If it's not being followed, let's make sure it is. Cities should and counties should tell districts what's going on. Our concern with the bill is twofold. One, that they don't have veto power, and two, that not stop the development process. Is already a fairly aggressive clock. As you know, the 120-day rule applies to land partitions or land use actions. We don't want that slowed down. The cities don't want that slowed down. I wouldn't think the districts would want that slowed down. So as long as this is notice only, and if the district is unhappy with what happens at the platting and permitting level, they go to LUBA like everybody else, we can get to a position of neutrality on this bill. At the moment, however, with the way it came out, we are opposed. With regard to Senate Bill 866, I signed up in that vague neverland between opposition and neutrality. On the one hand, this looks like a fight between friends of ours, and we obviously, depending on the jurisdictional proclivities of our building, we are dealing with a district for stormwater discharge or a city or a county agency with stormwater discharge, and there's no joy for us in irritating either of them, so we would hope that they get along well. I would simply point out, though, the bill makes me nervous because the hydrology being and gravity being what it is, and common sense being what it is, ditches and canals and other conveyances tend to be placed at low points as opposed to high points, and water tends to run from the high down to the low, with irrespective of jurisdictional boundaries or agreements or lack thereof. And we as developers, my clients, then are charged with treating stormwater as it comes off of a development site and putting it someplace other than the nearest creek, usually in a conveyance of some sort. We do not want that process impeded either. This bill strikes me as one that we could get to neutral on fairly easily. But it could also put us one into hard opposition because of the fee implications of an agreement between the districts and counties and cities that would cause system development charges and other sorts of mischief to go up at levels we might find extravagant. So this is an old issue, as was stated. The relationship between cities and counties and districts is oftentimes congenial, oftentimes turbulent. We hope that these bills can be taken to a place where they actually facilitates that process of agreement and cooperation going forward, and look forward to further conversations. We'd be glad to take any questions.
Okay, any questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Okay, Dave Honeycutt, Mark Landauer. And let's bring up let's just go with you two. And if you could be brief.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, here in opposition to Senate Bill 865. As Mr. Chandler said, if there are some amendments to this bill to ensure that the districts receive notice, that would be great. But the way the bill is drafted, it appears that it back ends the time that the districts are notified and can impose conditions of approval to the final plat stage rather than the earlier stage where all the land use work goes in. It seems to me that the districts would benefit from being involved during the land use during the tentative plans phase, where the land use work is being done, rather than once the tentative plan is approved and we're in the ministerial part of recording the final plat. So I think there's a timing issue. And the second issue is, I also believe, as Mr. Chandler indicated, that there is veto authority under this bill for the districts. That may not be what they intended, but I think that's the way that the bill is worded. And so if we can cut that back to the point where the districts are just receiving notice and they're doing it during the tentative plan stage, so that they can make their comments at the time that the rest of us would make comments, then we'd have no problem with this bill.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I had some of our folks at Special Districts Insurance System run some numbers for me. Over the last 10 years, the Special Districts Insurance System has received hundreds of claims by various individuals due to water intrusion or, for that matter, canal failure due to the building of what we call encroachments. This also applies to districts. As the chair knows very well, there's a very large levee protecting much of north and northeast Portland, and one of the problems with encroachments is that it undermines the integrity of real critical structure protecting developed land, jobs, an international airport, so on and so forth. The intent behind 865, I think, is a good one. It may not be executed precisely the way we would all like it to be done, but there really is a financial impact to these districts that when development takes place and encroachment occurs, it undermines that infrastructure. People tend to not get very happy when their basements get flooded or things of that nature. We've spent over $5 million in the last 10 years on these types of claims as a result, and we certainly hope that we can have some kind of a solution to this. I think folks are willing to have those discussions, but it is a problem, and I thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, can I have Brent Stevenson? Tracy, you want to come up now? We have some. Yeah, and Del McGill, thanks. Okay. Brent, you want to start off?
Thank you, Chair Dembro. Vice Chair Olson, Brent Stevenson with the I manage the Sandyham Water Control District in Staten, Oregon. Like to testify today in supporting the 866 stormwater bill. Our district is one that was severely impacted by stormwater. We have over several years spent a large chunk of our annual budget and most of our savings in trying to convey the difficulties that we have related to stormwater. And I think, you know, the bill's fairly simple. It's not trying to regulate rivers and streams and low points, and I think some of the other areas that you've heard from the others. It's clearly infrastructure that's owned and operated by a quasi-municipality. And so when we don't have control, full control over our owned facilities, we then suffer at the hand of others. And so we're asking for a means to have the open dialogue, have the communications, know where we stand, and not be surprised by a new development and a pipe in the side of an owned ditch that is recognized as an owned facility. It will only save money in the long run for others as we work together on these issues. And so I strongly support this measure.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, Tracy Rutten with League of Oregon Cities. I'm here today to express our opposition to Senate Bill 866 as it's been currently drafted. We have, as you've already heard, significant concerns that the language of this bill is incredibly broad. We've had our technical folks that work in stormwater, our MS4 Phase 1 and Phase 2 communities take a look at this bill. It appears to us that there is a significant potential for a fiscal impact that would be really detrimental to a number of communities. You already heard from Gresham about their potential fiscal impact on this bill. Another community the size of about 7,000 came up with a potential fiscal of $30 million to implement this legislation. Our interpretation of the bill is really that it would require us to manage stormwater, so water coming via typically rainfall at the boundary level, and really to try and find some way to retain that stormwater, so collect it, and then also divert that somewhere else. And that's currently far more stringent than what EPA guidelines require for even our MS4 Phase 1, so our large communities. So we see this bill as being a significant hurdle in terms of just how we would feasibly approach that in incredibly cost prohibitive at the same time. So in an effort to be short, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Tracy. Mr. McGill.
I may have put my name on the wrong list. I need to be on 187, the dairy project.
Oh, okay. Go away. Okay, our last two. Thank you both. Daryl Eish and David Sawyer are our last two people who signed up. Do we have Daryl Eish here? Okay, great. Okay, let's wrap this up then. Mr. Sawyer, is it?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is David Sawyer. I'm the city administrator in the city of Turner. Unfortunately, this small town south of this great capital is not a stranger to stormwater. We have a phase two MS4 NPDS permit, as well as a TMDL. They produce two plans that are about this thick. And I've served for 3.5 years on a DEQ rule writing task force, which we're still hoping to reach a positive conclusion. Clearly, stormwater is an issue, but the financial and regulatory burden, particularly for small towns, is also an issue in the debate. In the context of this bill, I see two pretty simple problems. I'll just mention that the northern stormwater basin that empties from the city of Turner towards Salem, the stormwater goes through 9 jurisdictional changes from the time the water hits the ground till it hits Mill Creek. And you just can't expect us to work out 9 different levels of boundary agreements and then have a bill that potentially can revoke those permissions at any time with no justification. And then if that happens, we have to produce plans relative to any one of those boundary changes and implement them to have zero effect. The language of the bill is no effect. Now, I have erosion control plans approved by DEQ, and by God, I do not manage sediment at zero. I manage it at a cubic foot. City of Kaiser manages it at a cubic foot. So there's a language issue here where if you had no adverse impact or other things like that, maybe there's a conversation, but at no impact, that's a blank check, and it's a little scary. The other thing I want to mention here is that, again, there is a large pile of regulatory authority that already provides, I would think, some public assurance about the quality of stormwater. I have 2 DEQ permits, and they are tasked with making sure that my stormwater runoff doesn't damage anything. I think the implication's clear there. We have a good program that works at that level. This is a broad reach that will create additional financial burden and actually some squabbles at a level between counties and cities, at county after county, city after city, which is probably unnecessary. Thank you very much. Willing to entertain any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yes, Vice Chair.
Thank you. Did you mention that we already have legislation, we already have laws that regulate this?
Well, Mr. Senator, what I'm referring to is that so I have 2 permits. Both of those have erosion control plans, let's say, for sediment transport that are approved by the state of Oregon under their responsibilities under the Clean Water Act. The only development I have in town has a 1200C permit, which is approved by DEQ under their authority to enforce the Clean Water Act. Don't we have enough? Do we have enough paperwork?
Thank you very much. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Sawyer. Okay, is there anyone I missed on this issue? Okay, we will be trying to bring the parties together and see what we can do with these. I think the Vice Chair is going to help me out with this and Beth. So please stay tuned. So with that, I will close the public hearings on 865 and 866, and we'll go back to Senate Bill 197. And I'd like to ask Lisa Hansen to come up, please. As you heard from the presentations from the senators, we had a work group or a task force that met back in the late teens and that led to a report on dairy air quality. And Lisa Hansen was part of that. And so kind of give us a little context, please.
Sure.
And I will say that report is available on our legislative information system.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. As Senator Dembrough said, I had the pleasure of serving on the Derriere Committee back in 2007. There are several other members of the committee that are here today that may want to speak to some of it as well. But to give you just a little bit of background, the legislature in 2007 passed Senate Bill 235. Senate Bill 235 was initially a governor's bill that was put into place to resolve some inconsistencies with the Oregon law and the federal clean air law. At the time, Oregon law exempted agriculture from any regulation under air laws, with the exception of field burning in the Willamette Valley. And some groups had petitioned EPA around this issue, and so the bill was put forward to do that. Ultimately, the bill went through several sets of amendments, and out of it came the authority for ODA and DEQ to enter into an MOA regarding any agricultural air emissions. It also provided it cleaned up the discrepancies between the federal law and the state law. It created the Derriere Task Force, and it also authorized the EQC in their discretion to implement any and all of the task force recommendations. Much of my testimony comes from testimony that Andy Ginsberg and I provided in September of 2008 when we reported out from the Derriere Task Force at that time. So the task force was a large task force made up of agency staff as well as members from the dairy industry, the environmental and public health community, as well as legislative members and two members from Oregon State University. We met seven times throughout the year prior to the report being made to the legislature. We met across the state, and we looked at different operations by region and the different challenges that those dairy operations had and how that would impact potentially their emissions. We studied and explored and debated the state of the science, regulatory frameworks outside of Oregon, and various options from doing nothing to traditional regulation. Much of this investigation looked at studies. We looked at how voluntary actions could impact emissions from dairy operations. We talked about regulation, and we even talked about the possibility of proposing legislation. The task force came to, I think, a conclusion at the time that there really was a need for additional understanding around what emissions were coming from dairies and how to quantify them. There was more science and work that needed to be done. EPA had initiated a study in 2006 to look at emissions. They have worked on that study, but the conclusions have yet to come forward. I think what I've taken from all of it is that there are a lot of variables when you talk about emissions coming from dairy operations, depending on the practices and the region in which the dairy operates. The task force recommended at the time a proactive approach to reduce emissions coming from dairies, starting with voluntary actions and maybe moving towards regulatory actions. Other states had programs that regulated dairy emissions. Some of them required permitting and the adoption of best management practices. At the time and still today, the focus on dairies is requirements around the Clean Water Act. The task force specifically recommended that the state of the science for dairies and air quality was still evolving, and that actions could be taken and should begin to reduce emissions from these facilities. It recommended that the EQC, working with the Department of Agriculture, DEQ, and the Department of Human Services, adopt rules and implement the proposed outcomes from the program and from the task force. The task force recommended that the CAFO program within the Oregon Department of Agriculture be used as a model, and that, again, it started as a voluntary program and moved towards a regulatory program. We had guiding principles in which a program should be adopted, initially focusing on ammonia, methanol, and odors. DEQ and ODA, in consultation with DHS, should convene a dairy air advisory committee, was one of the recommendations as well. And this should work together to develop a list of BMPs that were compatible with the BMPs that were used for water and have benefits to air as well. It was also recommended that tax credits be provided to farmers that complied with voluntary aspects of the program, that funding be provided for scientific research on best management practices for Oregon State University, and additional staff be provided to the agencies for information, assistance, and oversight of the program. Those were the key take-homes from that report. In response to the task force, ODA and DEQ had developed policy option packages during their agency request budget process the late summer of 2008. As you may remember, there was an economic downturn in 2009, and unfortunately, those packages were not included in the governor's recommended budget at the time. As the economy has turned around, investments have been made within ODA that have continued to focus on water and our ag water quality management program. During that time frame of 2011 to 2015, the Oregon Department of Agriculture provided funding of approximately $10,000 to the Western States Dairy Air Quality Symposium to continue to look at the evolving research around dairy air emissions. I believe you're going to hear from the industry today and some scientists that'll talk about what's happened in terms of work around best management practices since the time of the task force. So I will pause there and answer any questions, should you have them.
Thank you. Lisa, I do have a question. When Senator Hansel presented on the bill, he kind of framed the essence here as being about how one feels about large operations, the CAFOs. Was that the focus of the task force?
One of the acknowledgments in the task force, if you go back and look at the report, it actually talked about emissions from all dairies in Oregon. And so it was not, the task force work recommended that all dairies be treated equitably as we looked at emissions from these operations.
Vice Chair, Senator,
which is my question, because as I've looked at it, this task force recommendation is to regulate all dairies, not just, so that would be organic dairies, it would be any dairy that we have in Oregon, right?
So the task force recommendation was to look at implementing a program related to using best management practices for all dairies that would mitigate emissions coming from those facilities.
And do you have lists or numbers of how many small, medium, or, and what are the smallest dairies? What do we call a dairy? What's the definition of a smallest dairy?
Sure. So if it's acceptable, I would ask Wim Matthews from our staff who operates our CAFO program to come forward, because I think he can rattle those numbers off to you much faster than I could.
Because as you know, we have fairly large dairies in Tillamook. In Coos County, there's some smaller organic dairies. We've got one that's not organic. We've got eight that are organic. I mean, there's a lot of things that are dairy.
Oh, good afternoon. My name is Wim Matthews with the Oregon Department of Agriculture CAFO Program Manager. So Chair Dembro and members of the committee, as far as numbers of facilities that we permit under our CAFO Water Quality Permit Program, currently we have 260 dairies statewide under that permit. That's cow dairies, goat dairies, sheep dairies, and some dairy heifer feedlots. When you break that 260 number down by size, 45 of those are what we call large CAFOs, and that's 700 mature cows and larger. The next group is called medium facilities, 200 to 699 mature cows. We have 125 of those, and we have 90 small facilities, and those would be less than 200 mature animals.
So it could be two. You could have two cows, and you would be a dairy.
Yes, you would. If you had two cows and a dairy system with a liquid waste system, we would require a permit for that.
Okay.
And I think you asked a question about the smallest size of facility we permit. The small size we currently have permitted is 50 animals, but we do have pending applications for a 3-cow dairy and a 25-cow dairy. So that's on the small side. On the large side, the largest one with milking cows is 38,500. So a wide range of size facilities.
Okay. That's a lot of cows. Vice Chair Olson, and then I have a question for you, Wynn.
Thank you, and I'm glad you came up, Wynn, because this probably will more affect you, this question. When you're talking cows, whether 38,000 live together or two live over here, they kind of all produce the same stuff, if you know what I'm going with that. So what's the impact of, is there a difference in impact between a 25-farm cow as compared to 200 farm cow, cow farm, I should say, and the 38,500?
So, Vice Chair Olson and members of the committee, I would say that there are some scientists that are hopefully going to come up and speak after we're completed that probably have a better understanding of that. But I can give you a broad response to that. And I've always looked at the emissions from the animals as on a per animal basis. And so regardless of where the animals are located, each individual animal has an impact that you accumulate depending on their production system, their location.
And that's the answer I was looking for. Thank you. It's sure. Every cow is a cow.
Right. With respect to the CAFOs, one of the issues that's going on now is there's a new operation that's going into place in the gorge, and there was some press around some problems with that operation permit requests or so just some problems with it. And I'd like to know what the status of that is now and is that operation in compliance? Are they getting the kind of oversight that's required?
Sure, Chair Dembrow, members of the committee. This facility is, and I can speak to the water quality permit because right. That's what our department and Department of Environmental Quality are working on jointly. So the facility did complete its application to us, and we proceeded through a public notice and hearing process and a public comment period that expired in November 4th of last year. And the agencies are currently completing our response to comments on the permit and working on preparing those documents. So as far as the water permit is concerned, that entity has completed their work with us, and now it's in our court to respond to them.
Okay. Lisa, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just to add a little bit to maybe put it into the larger context, the facility is required to have permits from several different agencies. Those agencies are currently coordinating with assistance from the Governor's Natural Resource Office to work through the issues in the permitting process.
Senator Roper.
I just have to ask, have you seen the research on seaweed and mixed in cattle feed to cause the methane to go down?
Oh, I have not.
Okay, I'll have to get the research for you.
Yes. You may not know that seaweed comes from the coast.
But it also could be acidic.
Okay, thank you both of you for coming. I'm going to ask Ivan Molesky, Kendra Kimberanskas, and Lauren Goldberg, please. Come on.
Chair Dembrow, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ivan Molesky. I'm the policy director for Friends of Family Farmers. I really appreciate hearing the testimony from Lisa Hansen from ODA encapsulating what was done back in 2008 and the lead up to that and what's been done since. She's probably allowed me to cut my testimony a little bit short because of that. But at the end of the day, we want that. We want what we agreed to back in 2008. And so to the extent that we can make some modifications to handle the concerns that might be out there around small and mid-sized farms, let's work on an amendment if we need to. But I'll just go ahead and start my testimony here. I'm the policy director for Friends of Family Farmers. We represent small and mid-sized farms and ranches across Oregon, and we appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 197 today. This would ensure the adoption of a long overdue set of rules to regulate air contaminant emissions from large dairy confined animal feeding operations consistent with the Dairy Air Task Force report from 2008. Our organization actually served on the task force, and we count dairy farmers among our membership. Some of these farmers are among the best environmental stewards in the state, grazing animals on pasture, protecting soil and water, caring for the land, and producing the highest quality dairy products. We are firm believers that well-managed grazing and pasture management can be part of the solution to climate change and other environmental challenges. We are not anti-dairy. In fact, our strong support for small to mid-sized farms is why we are vocal critics of the trend toward larger and larger dairies that we believe have contributed to the dramatic decline of the small and mid-sized family dairy farms in this state. In fact, when we served on the Dairy Air Quality Task Force, the record will show, we advocated continuously for actually exempting small and mid-sized farms from the regulation. It was the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association and others that wanted to include all operations. In 2002, Oregon had over 1,100 dairy farms, mostly small and mid-sized, but now there are fewer than 250, a decline of more than 75%, even as overall cow numbers have gone up. According to the Oregon Employment Department, between 2002 and 2007, the first 5 years after Three Mile Canyon Farms came to the state, Oregon lost nearly half of its dairy farms, on average 9 per month for 5 straight years. At that point, Three Mile had over 50,000 cows on site, while the average dairy farm in Oregon had about 200. But it was the significant air pollution generated at Three Mile, which is part of why the Oregon legislature passed Senate Bill 235 back in 2007, and to ultimately establish this task force to make these recommendations. But despite our critiques of the trends in agriculture that Three Mile represents, we came together with them at the Dairy Air Quality Task Force in consensus a decade ago in supporting the Oregon Dairy Emissions Program, which included both voluntary and regulatory approaches to addressing air pollution. Unfortunately, a decade later, this program has still not been established, even as a new extremely large dairy with 30,000 cows is proposed for not far away. Senate Bill 197 would simply require that the Environmental Quality Commission move forward with the rules to create the Oregon Dairy Air Emissions Program consistent with the consensus of the Dairy Air Quality Task Force back in 2008. The recommendations originally called for this rulemaking to begin in late 2009. It included air quality monitoring, the development of voluntary best management practices, emissions targets, technical assistance, research, and agency staffing. In 2015, the emission targets were to become mandatory, and new dairies were to be required to comply with the program. Because we lack the program called for a decade ago, the state is woefully unprepared to address air pollution associated with increasingly large dairies moving into the state. It is our view that a state approach that only offers tax credits for manure digesters in the absence of an overarching air emissions program that the task force proposed is at risk of subsidizing large-scale confinement operations at the expense of smaller dairy operations where digesters are not needed due to their management practices or because they are not economical. Additionally, just to be clear, digester tax credits were never intended as a standalone approach. They were agreed to by the task force as part of a package of a larger air emissions program that included not only monitoring, but increased staffing, technical assistance, and support for a variety of best management practices, ultimately regulatory approaches aimed at curbing the most significant source of pollution. The Dairy Air Quality Task Force strongly recommended the creation of this program that is called for here in Senate Bill 197. It outlined a specific timeline and funding for agency staffing, monitoring, and potential tax credits to assist with compliance. The task force described their proposed program as, quote, an optimal balance between the need to protect air quality and ensure the viability of Oregon dairies. To be clear, it wasn't just us that supported this. It was the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. It was Three Mile Canyon Farms. It was Senator Betsy Johnson. It was Senator Ben Nelson and others. An optimal balance. That's what we called it. So the task force report has been provided to you. It's in OLIS. But I want to highlight just a few key elements before I wrap up here, if you haven't had the opportunity to read the report. Again, the task force expressed a desire to improve our understanding of emissions from dairies, improve our ability to quantify these emissions, and reduce these emissions and prevent future problems from arising. The program would start as a voluntary program and move into a mandatory program pursuant to the recommendations and schedule. The task force recommended an ongoing multi-stakeholder dairy air advisory committee to advise and make recommendations. The guiding principles included allowing flexibility for dairy farmers to make decisions that are compatible with their operations and environmental obligations and providing economic feasibility and stability. There was a phase one that was voluntary that was to begin in 2009 and moving into a state mandatory program called phase two in 2015. The task force agreed that new dairy should be required to comply with the program upon startup. ODA and DEQ were supposed to develop a list of interim recommended best management practices and to collect baseline data. And ultimately, the task force recommended that tax incentives be provided to encourage dairies to meet these best management practices and ultimately to incentivize early action. But I want to be clear, the tax credits were intended to cover a wide range of activities, not solely anaerobic digesters. Lastly, the guidance for the recommended BMPs included a tier-based system along the lines of what Mr. Matthews from ODA specified. Large dairies would be one tier, medium dairies would be another, and small would be another. So in the program, there's the opportunity to take a different approach for different operations. And in fact, if operations are doing a lot of good practices on the ground, they're not likely to come under any regulation. But again, if we need to sort of clarify what that looks like on the ground with an amendment around small and mid-size, we'd be happy to talk about that. So lastly, Senate Bill 197 does not stray from these recommendations. It merely ensures that the program we all agreed on as part of the Dairy Air Quality Task Force will finally be created. It explicitly requires consultation with agencies like the Oregon Department of Agriculture and the creation of a rules advisory committee that includes the dairy industry, environmental public interest groups, and academic experts. We strongly urge your support for this bill and to move it forward with the due pass recommendation to Ways and Means. Thank you.
Thank you. Kendra, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. Senator Dembrough and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kendra Kimbaraskis. In October 2007, I was appointed to Governor Ted I was appointed by Governor Ted Kulongowski to the Oregon Dairy Air Quality Task Force, which was established by the Oregon Legislature early that year. It was the great honor that I had to represent farmers and ranchers who were very concerned about the impact the air emissions from Three Mile Canyon Farms was having on public health, the quality of life of neighbors, and the Columbia River Gorge. One of those farmers unfortunately couldn't be here today, but I provided you with her testimony, and that's a neighbor, Jeanette Logan. Before I get into my testimony, it is important for you to know that I am quite familiar with agriculture. I raise hogs and beef cattle and poultry and goats on about 70 acres in Linn County. I am also very familiar with dairy, as I grew up on a dairy farm and spent many hours during my formative years milking cows with my dad. I saw and I felt the struggles of dairy farming as my dad and other farmers in my community were faced with low milk prices. Many dairy farmers, including my dad, couldn't survive the milk prices of the 80s. And despite the fact that many small and medium-sized farms have gone out of business over the years in my home community, the number of cows have increased on fewer farms. My dad has since passed, but I still own the family farm. Today, I lease it to a dairy farmer who now 2 years in a row I've had to work with on lease payments because it's costing him more to milk his cows than he's actually getting for selling his milk. I tell you this to say that I am quite familiar and very sympathetic with the struggles of family dairy farmers in the state, and the last thing I would ever want to do is to see a bill come forward that might make it more difficult for a small family dairy farmer to survive. The issues raised during the 2007 legislature were not about the impact that small and medium farmers were having on gorge air quality. It was specifically about the fact that Three Mile Canyon Farms, 55,000 cows at the time, was putting about 5.6 million pounds of ammonia gas into the air each year, and that those emissions were contributing to acid haze and rain in the eastern end of the gorge. Further, the state had no tools to require that the operation mitigate or reduce its harmful emissions. And let me say something about emissions from decomposing animal waste. Untreated liquefied manure releases over 160 toxic gases. These, in addition to ammonia, these gases include hydrogen sulfide, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and methane. The issues with these gases aren't that they just aren't aesthetically pleasing. It's that in high enough concentrations, these gases can kill you. Every single year, there seems to be a tragic story somewhere in some state where someone got too deep into a manure waste system, was overtaken by fumes, and died. These are dangerous gases. The Oregon Dairy Air Quality Task Force was set up specifically to come up with recommendations to address emissions while easing in an air quality program for dairies. As you can imagine, there were many that were very skeptical that such a diverse group, small farmers, environmentalists, the dairy industry, legislators, academics from OSU, and agency representatives would ever agree on anything. However, after 7 months of building trust and working relationships, while examining the science, we came up with a set of recommendations in 2008 that everyone agreed to. The task force came to a consensus and strongly recommended that beginning in 2009, the Environmental Quality Commission, working with the Department of Agriculture, DEQ, and Oregon public health agencies, adopt rules to address emissions. The program was to be informed by ongoing input from stakeholders, new scientific information, and it was to be scale appropriate. First voluntary, then mandatory. The task force described the program, the proposed program and timeline, as optimal balance between the need to protect air quality and ensure the viability of Oregon's dairies. Before today's hearing, I was listening to the audio from a hearing before this committee back in 2008, and I have submitted that for the record, when Mr. Marty Myers from Three Mile Canyon Farms, the ODA director at the time, Katie Koba, and Andy Ginsberg from DEQ reported back on the task force process. and the recommendations. It was a bit emotional for me to hear late Senator Alan Bates' voice, but what he had to say rang true, and it still rings true today for me. He said that the process that led to the Consensus Task Force recommendations represented the best of Oregon. And I believe that to be true. We were a set of diverse stakeholders coming from different places, and we put forward a plan for a program that had everyone's support. In fact, on our first task force meeting in January of 2008, Senator Betsy Johnson, who you heard from today, was asked what process success looks like, and she said the following, and this was according to the minutes from the meeting. This task force will work the best when participants represent Oregonians, not just their entrenched positions. We must be willing to come to the middle, see each other's perspective, and come together on recommendations. We should work to be proud of the process as well as the outcome. I believe that we did just that, and I am proud of the outcome. However, what I'm not proud of is that here we are 10 years later, and nothing has been done to move forward with the rules we all agreed to. The Consensus Task Force recommendations were the culmination of hard work, compromise, and countless hours of time from stakeholder representatives, including volunteers like me. The fact that some members of the task force have now walked away from the consensus we all shared to establish an air emissions program does not reflect the best of Oregon. The task force recommendations were a package, a complete program, not a single item. Senate Bill 197 is the next step in the process of actually seeing the full recommendations of the task force implemented, nothing more, nothing less. And the time is right. Despite the fact that the dairy task force recommended that emissions targets would become mandatory in 2015 and that new dairies should be required to comply with the program upon startup, we now have another proposed mega dairy under construction, this time with 30,000 cows. The facility has begun construction despite not having received a state water pollution permit, underscoring the need for Senate Bill 197. Oregon still has no rules in place to ensure our air quality is protected, that air emissions are monitored, or the means to ensure that emissions from this operation don't negatively impact the surrounding community or pollute the air. Mega dairies make it harder for family dairy farmers to compete, and we need rules in place so that Oregon doesn't become a magnet for these operations, making it increasingly difficult for the already struggling family scale farmer. One thing to note is that in the task force deliberations, we had many discussions about whether or not to include small and medium-sized dairy farms in the recommended air emissions programs. Small and mid-sized farms are not the problem when it comes to the biggest pollution issues the task force was tasked with addressing, but despite my best efforts to exclude small and medium-sized farmers, it was ultimately representatives from the dairy industry who insisted that all grade A dairy cow operations be covered in these recommendations. I urge you to support Senate Bill 197 with a do-pass recommendation, but I would also support an amendment that excluded small and medium-sized operations from mandatory emission mitigation requirements so that we can prioritize addressing the biggest sources. Thank you.
Thank you, Kendra. Lauren, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name is Lauren Goldberg. I'm the staff attorney with Columbia Riverkeeper. I represent our 12,000 members, the majority of which live, work, and recreate along the Columbia River in Oregon. Before I begin my testimony, I want to disclose my personal bias on this issue. I've been a resident of the Columbia River Gorge for the last 9 years, and I also have a four-year-old daughter who suffers from asthma. So as a parent who's watched a baby, a toddler, and now a preschooler suffer from that, struggle to breathe, I then putting on my attorney hat, when I look at our state statutes and regulations as they pertain to air quality, see a gaping loophole in how we treat various industrial sectors in our state. We recognized this need as a state in 2007 when the legislature passed SB 235, and Kendra and Ivan have provided detailed testimony on the task force, so I'm not going to dwell on that. But I will highlight for the committee that there are other states that have very large dairy industries, including Iowa, Idaho, California, Arizona, Minnesota, that have regulations in place to address, maybe not completely or as much as some of my colleagues would like to, but they do have regulations in place that address air pollution from dairies, that there is a recognized need for state oversight that goes beyond voluntary measures. And just to provide one example, you know, as an individual who spends most of my time focused on water quality laws, and particularly the industrial sector, looking at what's coming out of a pipe, you know, these are not types of regulations that are controlling emissions from smokestacks, obviously. For example, in Idaho, there's a menu of best management practices and a point system assigned to for the different best management practices, how effective those practices are in reducing air emissions. And then individual farms, mega dairies, must reach a certain point level to reduce air pollution. Lost Valley Ranch, which others have described, this is the proposal for over 30,000 head of cattle in Morrow County, is a perfect case study for why Oregon needs a program to address air pollution from large-scale dairies. I'm going to share with you public comments filed by the USDA Forest Service on the CAFO NPDES permit. That's the water pollution permit. So the Forest Service provided detailed comments, well-cited comments that raise only concerns related to air pollution. That's because they're looking out for the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area. It states, the Forest Service is concerned about the potential for adverse impacts to the Columbia River Gorge Scenic Area resulting from air pollutants emitted from this proposed facility. It goes on to describe the known air pollutants, including ammonia, nitrous oxide, nitrogen oxides, methane, etc., citing specific studies from the Columbia River Gorge from DEQ and the Southwest Clean Air Agency, Washington's equivalent to DEQ, that covers the gorge. And the letter ends with a specific ask to DEQ and ODA to provide monitoring to understand the amount of air pollution coming from this facility and to regulate it, to reduce those pollutants to protect, in this case, the scenic area. Well, DEQ and ODA are not armed with the laws and regulations right now to follow up on these very thoughtful remarks from the Forest Service, as well as thousands of other comments from constituents here in Oregon. Columbia Riverkeeper supports SB 197 because it's a common sense piece of legislation. It doesn't dictate what these rules will say. It sets up a committee process, but it moves forward a very thoughtful body of work that Kendra described, and as well as Ivan, that really puts at the forefront public disclosure, understanding how much air pollution is coming from these operations, and then addressing them as we would from any other industrial sector. And why? To protect public health, to protect our water quality, because there's a very close link between many of these air pollutants and degraded water quality, as well as our incredible scenic resources in throughout Oregon, as well as in the gorge. So I thank you today for the opportunity to speak and welcome any questions from the committee.
Thank you very much, Lauren. Thank you for your written testimony as well. Is there a way that we can easily access those comments from the Forest Service?
I'm happy to submit them, as well as comments filed by the Morrow County Court, which raises concerns, for example, related to fugitive dust emissions that are not within the purview of the CAFO NPDES permit.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Vice Chair.
For any on the panel, if this was a 30,000 cow operation for beef cows, would you have the same concern?
Chair Dembro, Senator Olson, I think the concerns would be a little bit different because what dairy cows produce in terms of air emissions is going to be different than beef cows. You're going to hear probably from some scientists talking about some of those differences. But that's not what we're here to talk about today, because Senate Bill 197 is exclusively focused on the dairy component, and we're just trying to stick very closely to what the consensus was. And at the time, we did not talk about looking at other sectors.
I understand that. Do we not have a law in our state that has the right to farm?
We do.
Okay. One of the concerns I have, and nobody's ever raised this, is that where I live, I have farm all around me, and I get 50,000 tons of chicken manure that spreads out around me. Pretty noxious, pretty nasty, lots of flies. My concern is the fact that as we attack more and more farmers, that's why we lose small farmers, and you want an exemption for small farmers, as we attack them and add more mandates to what they do. And you heard the Department of Agriculture say that a cow is a cow, whether it's one cow or 30,000 cows. The fact of the matter is that they produce just about the same. But you want to exempt small farmers, and I do too. But I want to make certain that we have an industry that's viable in this state, because I love to drink milk. And it seems that this is not an attack on cows and air quality. This is an attack on a large farm.
I have a problem with that.
I mean, did you want to respond to that about the cow is a cow? Is
Chair Dembro, Senator Olson, I mean, certainly a cow is a cow, but I guess you could multiply one by 30,000 and you'd have the difference between one cow and 30,000 cows in terms of total output of pollution. Again, you know, I'll just go back to the description. This process was considered by all, including the dairy industry, to be an optimal balance. It's primarily a voluntary program. It includes some regulatory approaches in the out years for particularly large operations. So we think it actually could, if structured well, could be very beneficial, especially if we structure some of the supportive tax policy to better support small and mid-sized farmers. We think it could actually be quite a benefit if we do it right. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Let me ask one question, then I'll let you go. Do you all have a sense of how voluntary programs are working now here in the state? Because, you know, the report recommended voluntary programs as a sort of phase one, and then regulation as a phase two. We're presumably still in phase one.
Sure. Chair Dembro, that's a great question, and I'd like to acknowledge there are a lot of voluntary measures that are being undertaken by dairy producers of all sizes, and that shouldn't be discounted, and we're not trying to discount that. I think the challenge is that we've never moved forward with part of the program that includes getting baseline data in terms of what some of the issues are. We've not had this sort of independent look at what some of the best practices could be. We've spent a lot of money on anaerobic digester tax credits, but nothing else when we've got other BMPs we could be also looking at supporting. So there's a real gap. I don't want to discount that there's some good practices going on out there, but I think we're at this point where we need to look at some of the deeper pieces that the task force identified.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, all three.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to ask Dr. Frank Mitlochner and Troy Downing, please, to come up. We'll have some scientific perspective here. And then, you know, I need to say we're getting close to 2:30. This is not a committee that can go forever because we have another one that's coming to take our place. So I'm afraid I won't be able to get to everyone today. The next panel after this that I'll call up includes some people who've come more than 100 miles, so I'll definitely want to get to them. And then we can talk about an additional hearing if necessary. I know many of you have submitted written testimony. But so, gentlemen, please, whoever wants to go first.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Can I actually use some visual aids, PowerPoint?
You have permission to use a visual aid.
Okay.
Yes.
How do I actually go about accessing this here? I'm not going to mess with anything until I
seal. All right, where would I?
Oh, is this the one that you submitted?
No. Already? It's submitted right here.
Okay.
Okay. So maybe. Maybe we could have the other presentation first while we're getting that set up. Okay. Should we do that? Yes, thank you.
Oh, this will only take a real quick second if you've already got that far.
Oh, he's already there.
Thank you.
Which one is that?
Air 17.
I guess we're ready.
Well, thank you for having us this afternoon. I'm Troy Downing. I work for Oregon State University as a state dairy extension specialist. And I've actually been working on nutrient management with our commercial dairy industry and other allied industries in the state for over 20 years, doing both educational programs and conducting applied research. And much of my effort over the years is focused on improving water quality. But I think it's important to understand that nitrogen management is always a driver in that process, and that all of our dairies that are permitted in the state have animal waste management plans that also look at ammonia emissions as part of the nitrogen management. One of the things that's been really amazing to me over the years is we have seen significant improvements in water quality in Tillamook. And this graph here shows you bacterial numbers started back in 1997 through 2009. That have been collected by our Tillamook Estuary Partnership, DEQ, and other volunteers. And I think this is really a result of our dairy industry stepping up, using best management practices,
And the water quality data has been impressive. They've actually removed this major river, the Wilson River, off the 303D list for being impaired by, for bacteria. I'm having flashbacks of the task force meeting. There's a lot of comments that were ringing true. There really were a variety of perspectives in the room, and I think what got written up, in my opinion, was an average of those. But I understand sort of the frustration by some, but I'm here to tell you that a lot of things have been done since that task force meeting. The world hasn't stopped. At that time, we really didn't have very good science in our scientific community to make great decisions. Part of the recommendation there was to fund some research, but as the decade's almost gone by, I can tell you the research has been generated around the country, and actually my colleague here, Frank Mitlohner, Dr. Mitlohner from UC Davis, is really one of the leading air emission researchers in the world, and I'm happy he's here today, and a lot of the things that I do are in reference really to the great work that he's done. I'll let him introduce himself. But essentially, I've been working with best management practices since the task force meeting with our dairy industry the whole time. In 2009, a colleague of mine, Mike Gamroth, and I myself created an extension bulletin on controlling ammonia, which was one of the main pollutants of concern of the task force. Used this as an educational tool with our dairy industry. And of course, our understanding of ammonia emissions has evolved over time. This publication needs to be updated, but we did use this for a number of years with our industry. But best management practices is really what drives our ability to manage air emissions. The technology keeps changing, our options keep changing. And the good news is a lot of dairies have been trying to address odor, and a lot of those practices then have been also reducing emissions on our farms. And so I can tell you today, when we look at the whole list of best management practices available to us, and I actually did submit a teaching document that I used with our industry for your reference today, but a large portion of our dairies are doing a significantly large portion of those practices, and our largest dairies essentially are doing all those practices. So that's kind of the ironic thing when we're talking about regulating our large dairies. Actually, most of the research and a lot of the innovation development is occurring at some of our largest dairies around the country. We do have totally different numbers today on what's coming off our ponds than we did 10 years ago. 10 years ago, we really couldn't even talk about what was average or normal. It's extremely expensive and challenging to measure this stuff, but the work's been done. And so at least the scientific community, in my mind, particularly after the national study, has some sort of agreement on what these are. We know a whole lot more about feed management. Dr. Mitlohner's done a lot of work looking at volatile organic compounds and silage and feeding. We've also seen an industry reduce the amount of protein in the ration from 18% or 19% a decade ago down to 16.5% or 17%. That reduced protein in the ration actually means we have less nitrogen coming out of the back of the cow, reduced emissions. We've seen a lot of our big gun applicators disappear and more boom type applicators. This has reduced our ammonia, nitrous oxide, and particulate matter emissions. As been referenced earlier, we've seen a number of manure digesters built. These are more economical in our larger facilities, but I'm estimating that about 30% of our cows in the state since the Dairy Air Task Force have been included in a manure digester, including a lot of small facilities in Tillamook. This has improved air quality. Speaking of air quality, I think it's important to understand EPA has an air quality index that they use. It's designed to help us understand the quality of air and the potential associated human health effects. And it takes a combination of a number of primary pollutants that we're concerned about. There's a index then that ranks air quality between 0 and 500. And 0 and 50 is considered good or essentially good, clean, healthy air. 51 to 100 would be moderately impaired and would be the yellow bar that you see up there. And there's potentially some folks that are asthmatic or have other associated risks that might have some problems, but for the most part, people function fairly well in that category. And as air quality gets worse, the index goes up higher. In December of, I think it was December 13th, I was doing a program at one of our dairy farmers meetings earlier this year, and I showed them this map. If you go to epa.gov/airnow and click on Oregon, you can get real-time information on what air quality is like in our state. And you can see there's a yellow spot essentially in the Willamette Valley. This was a period of really cold snap. We had a lot of people using wood stoves around Cottage Grove and Eugene. And that's what we kind of, that's when we have, when we kick into the yellow range in Oregon, we typically see it in Klamath Falls, Oak Ridge, and in that region. This is the same map this morning. We're all green air, high quality. Actually, we have pristine air here in Oregon. And we certainly want to keep it that way. I want to share one other tool we have as an industry. There was a national effort put together to understand livestock emissions, and this website is basically an assessment tool for all livestock producers to assess their impacts on all those emissions. So odor, particulate matter, ammonia, hydrogen sulfide, methane, volatile organic compounds, and nitrous oxide. And essentially each individual operation, if you're a dairy, you go in there, you answer about a half dozen questions on each of these parameters there on the left: animal housing, feed and water, collection, transfer, manure storage, and you get this printout then. The more green you have, the better job you're doing implementing practices to reduce that particular emission. And if you toggle on each one of those switches at the time, you'll actually go to the Natural Resource Conservation Service, USDA, spec sheets that give you advice on how to implement this. This is basically the best information we have in terms of regulating or helping livestock producers understand their emissions. So,
and so Troy, how widely has that been used?
Well, I don't know about how often it's being used, but I'm using this information as part of my educational programs is really what I'm trying to help you understand. Part of it is the science has evolved in 10 years, and this website's maintained by a group of people that are continually making sure it's accurate.
Mr. Chair?
Just before, sure. Troy, if you could back away from the mic, it's really sensitive. I guess we're getting some feedback.
I'm sorry.
No.
Push it forward.
Just push it forward.
Okay.
You don't need to be anywhere near it.
All right. Well, I felt like I needed to be closer.
No.
Could you back up one screen, please?
Sure.
And the lower left-hand corner there, it says perception. What is that for?
I can't remember the questions associated with that, but there are some questions that are associated with that toggle. And so I don't know whether that's, can your neighbor see your big gun when you're pumping? How far away is your closest neighbor? I don't remember exactly what questions there are, but, well, sure, it's perception of odor. So it's trying to help you understand how visible your operation is to your odor perceive, or your neighbor's perceiving you might have an odor problem.
Odoriferousness.
Yeah. So I didn't want to take a lot of time, but I did want you to understand the things that we've been doing. And in my opinion, working with the industry like I have on nutrient management for a lot of years, I mean, I really don't think we have a pressing air concern, particularly as it relates to public health, except for wood stoves in a few communities. And so I have concern about passing a bill to the DEQ that asks them to make up regulations regulating an industry when we don't even know what the problem is. I mean, if you can tell me exactly what the problem is, I would have been working on it. I thought I have been working on it for the past decade. We do have outstanding research that's changed our perspective, and it's daily coming into play in terms of helping us make better decisions on dairies. It's important to understand that we measuring emissions is complex. It's expensive. We have many BMPs, and we continue to implement those just about as fast as we can come up with them, particularly our larger dairies are implement them. And I think although it's harder to measure, in my opinion, our industry is making as much progress improving air quality just like we've done water quality in Tillamook. But again, it's harder to measure. So with that, I'll take any questions. Or
okay, let's hear from Dr. McNamara
okay.
First. So thank you, Troy.
Good afternoon, Chairman Dembro and members of the committee. My name is Frank Mitlerner, and I'm a professor and air quality specialist at the University of California, Davis. I have been a faculty member there since 2002, and I serve as statewide cooperative extension specialist for air quality. I have also served as director for research in the Western Center for Agricultural Health and Safety. Recently, I served as chairman on a United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization Committee project aiming at the benchmarking of environmental impacts of livestock. I have also served for the White House on a committee called PCAS, the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, and I was a member on the National Academies of Science project to assess the impacts of our food system on human and planet health. Most importantly, I've conducted state and federally funded large-scale air emissions, human exposure, and health research projects on commercial dairies and other livestock operations. I have accompanied the California air quality agencies in the drafting and implementation of air quality rules 4550 and 4570 as they pertain to volatile organic compounds and particulate matter emission reduction. I have personally trained more than 1,000 California dairymen on air permit and emission mitigation measures throughout our state. Today I want to opine on the issue of air quality in Oregon, the effects of dairy operational size on air quality, and on the effects of dairy air pollutants on exposure and health of nearby residents. California differs very significantly from Oregon with respect to air quality. If you look at the topography of California, you see two large mountain ranges surrounding the Central Valley, where the majority of our dairy population resides. In this San Joaquin Valley, we have the nation's worst air quality, with extreme non-attainment for many of the major pollutants. In contrast to California, all Oregonians live in areas that meet federal air quality standards and regulations. However, nowhere else in the U.S. are there any more stringent laws regulating air, water, and climate impacts of dairies than there are in California. I want to share some of those lessons learned. Since implementation of the California rules 4550 and 4570, the California dairy industry has decreased from originally 2,000 dairies to now 1,300 dairies. But even though we have lost 700 dairies, or one-third of our number of dairies in the state of California, we have not lost a single cow, meaning the remaining dairies have grown in size and the small dairies have disappeared. Undoubtedly, we have found in California that the regulations that we implemented were easily met by large, modern, and efficient dairies. Small dairies largely seem to have had problems, and in California, they are now largely a topic of the past, I have to say. Over the years, I have done extensive research on not just emissions from dairies and emission mitigation, but also the human exposure and health effects of dairy pollutants to people's health. And one of these studies, for example, a NIOSH, National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, funded $1.7 million study, made us basically measure the emissions or measure the exposures of all workers on 20 commercial dairies to air pollutants, and we then assess the health consequences. If these consequences were significant, that's what the assumption was, nearby neighborhoods, nearby surrounding communities would be exposed to even higher levels. What we found, though, was that for all but one jobs on commercial dairies, exposures were not health relevant in a way that people would have gotten sick and or put at hazard. In my opinion, the decision at hand here in Oregon is whether the state is willing to follow the California model. Considering that Oregon air quality is comparably pristine, the question is if the state is willing to unintentionally sacrifice small farms that have much harder time complying with stringent air quality rules. The other question is what the end goal is that's lying ahead. The air quality in Oregon is great. So what do you want to improve and at what cost? I appreciate the opportunity to speak in front of this committee and offer California lessons learned to help you arrive at effective approaches to protect your natural resources and your citizens' health and welfare without impeding Oregon's financial agricultural viability. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doctor. Questions?
Yeah, I have a couple. Troy, if you would you please repeat your EPA air quality website?
Sure, it's just epa.gov/airnow. And once you get on that, you can look up Oregon as a whole state, or you can compare Jackson County to Lane County. There's a whole variety of history and comparisons.
Thank you. Fellow?
Yes.
We have time.
If you can make it fast, I have a question, too.
Go ahead. Okay.
Yeah.
Doctor, in our testimony here, we have a letter from a series of 27 different physicians. Are you familiar with those physicians?
With some of them, yes.
Do you know who they are and why they prescribe that we should do this?
Well, I don't want to speculate on their motivation, but I do know of some of those colleagues from Johns Hopkins University. Some of them are contributors to the well-known Meatless Monday campaign, a campaign that drives people to eat less meat to protect climate. That's how I know them, because I've been chairman of a United Nations committee, as I alluded to, and they responded to some of our findings. What I do also know is that while I understand their concern for public health, because that's their jobs, I do also think that by looking at the terminology they use and the wording of the letter, that this group of people is not well familiar with operational considerations on dairies and consequences of conducting dairying and resulting effects on exposure and health of people. We are.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. Doctor, you suggested that going forward with this legislation would put small and medium-sized operations at risk. We've heard a proposal from the advocates to amend the bill so that it would only apply to large operations. Now, that's an issue we need to consider on its own merit, but if that were done, that would presumably remove that particular challenge that you mentioned. And so I'd like to know your thoughts about that. And then also, we heard testimony that there is some federal concern or concern from the Forest Service about a very localized effect in the gorge where we have a scenic area. And so potentially, I haven't read the report yet or their comments, but, you know, potentially, although largely the state's air is pristine, there could be some localized issues. Is that not true?
Yeah, Chairman Dembro, your first question first. There's a misconception that size matters with respect to larger dairies emitting more pollutants. If I were to ask you whether a bus or a car has greater emissions, greater air emissions, then you would probably say, well, the bus. But what you really have to consider is the activity behind it. The activity when it comes to transportation is getting people from A to B, a certain number of people from A to B. If you have cars transporting people from A to B versus a bus, then the bus is way more efficient. Even though the bus has greater emissions as a vehicle, once you calculate it based on person transport, then the bus is much more efficient. And the reason why I'm bringing you this analogy is because the same holds true in livestock operations. The large facilities are way more efficient, and that allows them to comply more easily with many of the stipulations that numerous bodies throughout the world have put forward. The FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, says today that production intensity and emission intensity are inversely related. I know that's a mouthful. What it means is when production goes up per cow, emissions go down per cow. And this is a notion that people not easily understand until you go and use analogies, let's say fuel efficiency in cars. We all understand that a more fuel efficient car is one that produces fewer emissions. The same holds true for cows. The more efficient you become, the less emissions you have. And that's the reason why large dairies per unit of product produced don't have more but less emissions. And so the notion that a large dairy, let's say a 1,000-head dairy, is the same as 10, 100-head dairies is wrong. By and large, as a rule of thumb, the large dairy would have lower emissions than 10 of its smaller competitors.
Thank you both. Thank you both for appearing. So we've heard some great testimony, and but we've run out of time. We have two individuals who signed up who have come from more than 100 miles away. I know at least one of you has put written testimony, but if you'd like to come up and make a brief comment, I'd appreciate that. Chad Allen, Sarah Bobian, and Marty, I don't know if you're from over 100 miles, but you didn't check it. But if you two would like to come, or you three would like to come up and just take 1 minute. And I am going to talk to stakeholders about scheduling an additional hearing on this subject. This is obviously a rich one in a variety of ways. And I think we have a lot more to look at here. So again, if you could stay away from your written testimony and just talk to us for a minute, that would be great. Sarah.
Thank you, Chair Dembro and Vice Chair Olson and members of the committee for the opportunity to come before you today. I was planning to read a couple highlights from our testimony, and then I can elaborate on those if there are any further questions. There's just a couple of sections that I want to bring to your attention.
Okay, we don't have time for that. We actually have to be out of here in like 3 minutes.
Okay, well then so I'll hand it over to Chad and Marty, and if we have any additional time, then
you.
I could bring those points
and
forward.
I apologize.
That's okay.
Yeah. Chad, hi.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Chair Dembrough. My name is Chad Allen. I'm the president of the Oregon Dairy Farmer Association, and I'm certainly here to encourage you to vote to not move this bill any further. Any consideration for only allowing this for large dairies, in my opinion, attack on one of us is an attack on all of us. And at only, you know, less than 228 dairy farms in Oregon, if you ever wanted to know what it's like to be endangered, be a dairyman. The amount of regulations that we currently face is astronomical, and the amount of time that we spend on keeping records to meet those regulations is time-consuming, but we do it in good faith. We've worked hard. I'm from Tillamook, and since the introduction of the CAFO program 20 years ago, we have done our due diligence, and those efforts have been shown in those water quality reports that have been taken by third parties, and I'm here to speak proud of that. And dairymen take the environment extremely serious, and we have gone through a lot of those best management practices that Troy alluded to in the last 10 years. Digesters are not just important for and used by large dairies, but they're also used by small dairies. The two that we have three in Tillamook, and two of them are community digesters utilized by several small dairies. And so those Biomax tax credits are critical to help those keep running. I know that there was another bill heard on the House side by proponents of this particular bill that were supporting that, and that's been a huge asset on reducing emissions that they're concerned of, and so it's been a key part for helping us. So thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Chad. Marty, welcome. Good to see you.
Yeah, Chair Demereau and members of the committee. I'll keep it short. Also, this point. So, you know, I've got several things that I was going to talk to. I'm going to talk to just a few things. Number one, the employee and community health issues. We had NIOSH, who Dr. Mitloner referred to, on the farm in 2006 and 7, actually in August, at the highest temperature point of the season. And NIOSH came away with all of our employees, were in air quality that met all attainable standards. So the myth that large dairies creates problems for their employees and their communities is one that I would have to refute and say that's a myth. The other thing that I want to show you is the map of our farm. The best management practice that you can ever do is have airspace in air quality issues. The map on the screen there is 145 square miles. So our density of animals is less than 2 animals per acre. It's 93,000 total acres. That map represents the size of the city of Portland. So for us to have animals in agriculture on a large airspace and have buffer zones from the community, the nearest community is Boardman, Oregon, 17 miles from our dairies. We have our own buffer zone of our own land, gives us 9 to 10 miles of buffer space in any one direction. So that's the best BMP you could ever introduce. On top of that, I'd put our BMPs up against anybody in the state. We do have methane digesters. The lagoons that you saw pictures of, the average retention time in our lagoons is less than 20 days on a year-round basis. During the irrigation season, it's less than 10 days. So we're applying those nutrients out on our fields. We're actually avoiding $5 million of fertilizer costs that would normally be produced from fossil fuels, and using that manure from the cows, which is a BMP, and it was called out in the Gorge Report, the final Gorge Report in 2011. Three Mile Canyon Farms is called out for their BMPs. So I just want you to understand we're a leader. We're a leader in animal welfare. We're a leader in workforce. And we're a leader in BMPs for air quality. So please take that into consideration as you vote no on this.
Thank you, Marty. I think we'll leave it at that. We'll let that be the last words on this issue for today. But we will come back and do some more looking at it. I just want to apologize again for this, but it's because we get followed by another committee now. So thank you, everyone who came, particularly those who came from a distance to share their expertise. And so for today, I'm going to close this public hearing on Senate Bill 197, and we are adjourned.
Wipe out all my time. Unbelievable. Wipe out all my time. Unbelievable.
Turned.